Shackleton did not press them, and after a time they turned to the job of sorting out equipment and stowing it securely on the sledges. It was a quiet time, and very few orders were given. Everyone understood his job and went about it without having to be told. The plan, as they all knew, was to march towards Paulet Island, 346 miles to the northwest, where the stores left in 1902 should still be. The distance was farther than from New York City to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and they would be dragging two of their three boats with them, since it was assumed that they would eventually run into open water. McNeish and MacLeod began mounting the whaler and one of the cutters onto sledges. The boats with their sledges would weigh more than a ton apiece, and nobody had any delusions that it would be easy to drag them over the chaotic surface of the ice, with its pressure ridges occasionally two stories high. Nevertheless, there was a remarkable absence of discouragement. All the men were in a state of dazed fatigue, and nobody paused to reflect on the terrible consequences of losing their ship. Nor were they upset by the fact that they were now camped on a piece of ice perhaps 6 feet thick. It was a haven, compared with the nightmare of labor and uncertainty of the last few days on the Endurance. It was quite enough to be alive, and they were merely doing what they had to do to stay that way. There was even a trace of mild exhilaration in their attitude. At least they had a clear-cut task ahead of them. 9 months of indecision, of speculation about what might happen, of aimless drifting with the pack, were over. Now they simply had to get themselves out, however appallingly difficult that might be. Periodically throughout the day, little groups of men made pilgrimages back to the derelict that had been their ship. But she was no longer a ship. She was not even afloat, really. She was a torn, twisted framework of wood. The ice, in its frenzy to wreck her, had driven through her sides and remained there, supporting the broken hull. She would remain on the surface only as long as the pressure lasted. On one trip, a group of men ran the Blue Union Jack up to the forward yardarm, the only rigging still standing. When the Endurance went, she would at least go with her colors flying. The work of packing the sledges continued the next day, and in the afternoon, Shackleton called all hands together into the center of the circle of tents. His face was grave. He explained it was imperative that all weight be reduced to the barest minimum. Each man, he said, would be allowed the clothes on his back, plus 2 pairs of mittens, 6 pairs of socks, 2 pairs of boots, a sleeping bag, 1 pound of tobacco, and 2 pounds of personal gear. Speaking with the utmost conviction, Shackleton pointed out that no article was of any value when weighed against their ultimate survival, and he exhorted them to be ruthless in ridding themselves of every unnecessary ounce, regardless of its value. After he had spoken, he reached under his parka and took out a gold cigarette case and several gold sovereigns and threw them into the snow at his feet. Then he opened the Bible Queen Alexandra had given them and ripped out the flyleaf and the page containing the 23rd Psalm. He also tore out the page from the book of Job, with this verse on it: "Out of whose womb came the ice, and the hoary frost of heaven, who hath gendered it? The waters are hid as with a stone, and the face of the deep is frozen." Then he laid the Bible in the snow, and walked away. It was a dramatic gesture, but that was the way Shackleton wanted it. From studying the outcome of past expeditions, he believed that those that burdened themselves with equipment to meet every contingency had fared much worse than those that had sacrificed total preparedness for speed. As the afternoon wore on, the number of non-essentials dumped in the snow grew steadily. It was an extraordinary collection of stuff, James noted. Chronometers, axes, an ophthalmoscope, saws, telescopes, socks, lenses, jerseys, chisels, books, stationery, and a large number of pictures and personal keepsakes. For some men, the 2 pound limit on personal gear was relaxed for special reasons. The 2 surgeons, of course, were permitted a small amount of medical supplies and instruments. The men with diaries were allowed to keep them, and Hussey actually was ordered to take his zither banjo along, even though it weighed 12 pounds. It was lashed in its case under the bow sheets of the whaler to keep it out of the weather. The journey would begin the next day. On the eve of setting out, Shackleton wrote, "I pray God I can manage to get the whole party safe to civilization." October 30th was grey and overcast, with a bit of occasional wet snow. The temperature was an uncomfortably warm 15 degrees, which made the surface of the ice soft, far from ideal for sledging. They spent the morning readying the last bit of stores. About 11:30, Shackleton, with Wilde, went out to prospect for a route. Before he left, Shackleton ordered the three youngest puppies killed, along with Sirius, an older puppy from an earlier litter, whose only fault was that he had never been broken to harness. McNeish's tomcat, which had mistakenly been named Mrs. Chippy before his sex was determined, also was to be destroyed. There was only food for those who could pull their weight. Tom Crean, tough and practical as ever, took the younger puppies and Mrs. Chippy some distance from camp and shot them without a qualm. But it was Macklin's duty to destroy Sirius, and he could hardly face the task. Reluctantly, he got a 12-gauge shotgun from Wilde's tent, then led Sirius off toward a distant pressure ridge. When he found a suitable spot, he stopped and stood over the little dog. Sirius was an eager, friendly puppy, and he kept jumping up, wagging his tail and trying to lick Macklin's hand. Macklin kept pushing him away until finally he got up nerve enough to put the shotgun to Sirius's neck. He pulled the trigger, but his hand was shaking, so he had to reload and fire a second time to finish the puppy off. The journey was begun about 2 p.m. Shackleton, Wordy, Hussey, and Hudson went ahead with a sledge and an assortment of shovels and mountaineering pickaxes. They tried to guide the main party along a level route, but every few hundred yards it was necessary to cross a pressure ridge. Then they set to work, chopping away at it until they had carved out a miniature mountain pass for the boats. On particularly high ridges, they had to build a ramp of ice and snow up one side and down the other. The teams came next, pulling sledges loaded up to 900 pounds apiece. The boats, drawn by 15 men harnessed in traces under Worsley's command, were last. It was killing toil. Because of their weight, the boats sank into the soft surface of the snow. To move them, the men in the traces had to strain forward, at times leaning nearly parallel with the ground, and the whole operation was more like ploughing through the snow than sledging. Shackleton wisely instructed the party to advance in short relays of about a quarter of a mile each. He was fearful that cracks would open up, and if the line of march was stretched out over a long distance, the party might be divided. Their progress was slow and arduous, for all hands had to retrace their steps every 1,000 yards or so. By 5 p.m., after 3 hours on the trail, they were 1 mile from the ship in a direct line, though with detours they had travelled perhaps twice that far. Some of the dog teams, which had gone back time after time to bring up equipment, had probably covered more than 10 miles altogether. Supper was at 6 o'clock, and the weary men immediately crawled into their sleeping bags. During the night, it began to snow heavily, and by dawn there was a mushy 6-inch blanket. The temperature soared to 25 degrees, making the prospects for sledging extremely bad. In the morning, Shackleton and Worsley found a fairly good route to the west, and the whole party set out at 1 o'clock. But it was torturously slow going in the deep snow, and most of the men were sweating profusely and beset by thirst within minutes. Their major efforts were devoted to beating down a path in the snow for the boat sledges. Even so, the 15 men on the boats felt as if they were hauling their burdens through mud. After a time, Wilde and Hurley took their teams back to help. They hitched onto the cutter and succeeded in getting it moving. About 4 p.m., having covered only a scant 3/4 of a mile, the party arrived at a thick level floe. Since there wasn't another suitable camping place within sight, Shackleton decided they would spend the night where they were. Almost as fast as the tents were pitched, they were soaked inside, It was impossible to crawl into them without bringing in quantities of wet, clinging snow. Macklin commented, "I cannot help feeling sorry for Worsley at the mouth of our tent, for he gets the wet brought in by everybody." Worsley, however, was far from distressed. He wrote in his diary that same night, "The rapidity with which one can completely change one's ideas and accommodate ourselves to a state of barbarism is wonderful." Shackleton was pleased by the general cheeriness of the man. "Many look on this as a spree," he recorded. "It is better so." He also observed, "This flow really strong. We'll sleep tonight." The flow was indeed a giant, more than a half mile in diameter, and made up of ice 10 feet thick, with 5 feet of snow on top of that. It was probably more than 2 years old, Worsley estimated. Its sturdiness was very much on Shackleton's mind the following morning, when he went out with Wilde and Worsley to look for a route. They saw tumbled confusion to the west. "A sea of pressure," Shackleton declared. "Impossible to advance. The boats and sledges would not last 10 miles over such a surface." On the way back to camp, Shackleton came to a decision. When he arrived, he called all hands together. He told the men that they had made less than a mile a day, and that the route ahead appeared to get progressively worse. Their advance, he said, hardly merited the effort it required, and since they were not likely to find a better place to camp, they would stay where they were until the drift of the ice should carry them closer to land. There was a flicker of disappointment on several faces, but Shackleton allowed no time for regrets. He dispatched dog teams back to the original camp, 1.75 miles to the rear, to bring up all the food, clothing, and gear possible. Wilde, with 6 men, were sent back to the ship to salvage anything of value. When they reached the Endurance, they discovered that in the past 2 days, the ice had further mutilated her twisted hull. Her bow had been shoved deeper into the ice so that the entire forecastle was submerged and littered with bits of floes. Her rigging was an indescribable tangle of broken masts and snarled tackle, which had to be cut away to make it safe to work. Later, they hacked a hole in the galley roof and recovered a few cases of stores. But their biggest prize for the day, which required the combined efforts of several dog teams to get back to camp, was the third boat. For supper that night, Shackleton ordered Green to put some lumps of blubber into the seal meat stew so that the party might get accustomed to eating it. Some of the men, when they saw the rubbery cod liver oil-flavored chunks floating around in their hoosh, meticulously removed every trace. But the majority were so hungry, they were delighted to gobble down every mouthful, blubber included. Chapter 2. They had been on the ice exactly 1 week. In 7 short days, they had gone from the well-ordered, even pleasant existence on board the Endurance to one of primitive discomfort, of unending wet and inescapable cold. A little more than a week before, they had slept in their own warm bunks and eaten their meals in the cozy atmosphere around the mess table. Now, they were crammed together in overcrowded tents, lying in reindeer or woolen sleeping bags on bare ice, or at best on odd pieces of hard lumber. At mealtimes, they sat in the snow, and each man ate out of an aluminium mug called a pannikin, into which everything was dumped at the same time. For utensils, each had a spoon, a knife, and his fingers. They were castaways in one of the most savage regions of the world, drifting they knew not where, without a hope of rescue, subsisting only so long as Providence sent them food to eat. And yet, they had adjusted with surprisingly little trouble to their new life, and most of them were quite sincerely happy. The adaptability of the human creature is such that they actually had to remind themselves on occasion of their desperate circumstances. On November 4th, Macklin wrote in his diary, "It has been a lovely day, and it's hard to think we are in a frightfully precarious situation." It was an observation typical of the entire party. There was not a hero among them, at least not in the fictional sense. Still, not a single diary reflected anything beyond the matter-of-fact routine of each day's business. There was only one major change in their general outlook, their attitude toward food. Worsley, had this to say. It is scandalous. All we seem to live for and think of now is food. I've never in my life taken half such a keen interest in food as I do now.